State highways across Wyoming and into the Plains states are shut down today due to an early spring blizzard. Forecasters say the storm could drop as much as 40 inches of snow to at least one mountainous area. In addition, the storm has sent temperatures plunging, and winds have been reported gusting to more than 60 miles an hour. The conditions have prompted officials to close Mount Rushmore National Memorial in South Dakota's Black Hills. Officials say that long stretches of I-25, I-80, and I-90 in Wyoming and South Dakota have been closed. Western Nebraska got snow yesterday, but in other parts of the state, several tornadoes were reported. Emergency officials now are surveying damage at 11 sites in the Lincoln area. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at breakthroughcollaborative.org.
Are these people in your carpool?
This is David Inge.
I'm Celeste Quinn.
I'm Scott Simon.
I'm Carl Castle from NPR News.
Whether you're coming or going, you depend on us to keep you company. We depend on you for financial support to make that possible. Give to our member match fund today, and we'll use your dollars on April 15th to challenge others to help make great programs possible on WILL. Go to willpledge.org or call 217-244-9455.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta is now open in their new location at Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. It's estimated that over 7,000 people have died in drug-related violence in Mexico since the beginning of 2007. Our guest for this hour, Sam Quiñones, a reporter for the LA Times, has traveled throughout most of Mexico. He's written two books about the country. He says that he now struggles to recognize the place that he has spent so much time covering. He says the country is fighting for its life, but most Americans have no idea what's happening right next door. This morning in this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking with Sam Quiñones about current developments in Mexico and what they mean for the United States. And, of course, questions and comments from people who are listening are welcome. Our guest has been a journalist for some time now. He's written for a number of papers, including not only the LA Times, but also the Orange County Register and the Tacoma News Tribune. He worked for an English language magazine called Mexico Insight, and he has authored two books. The first, True Tales from Another Mexico, that was published in 2001, and Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration, that was published in 2007, both those books published by the University of New Mexico Press. Also, by the way, if you're interested in doing some reading on this subject, that is Mexico and what's going on there, and particularly what's been happening involving drugs and drug-related violence, a good place to go would be to the website of the Los Angeles Times. They have grouped together a lot of the reporting that the paper has done and put together a really nice website. So, again, if you're interested in reading on that subject, you can, and you have internet access, you go to the LA Times website. And, of course, this morning here, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Quiñones, oh, hello.
Hello. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks. And yourself?
Not bad.
Good. I appreciate you spending some time talking with us.
My pleasure.
I freely vamped a little bit off of some of the comments that you made in an interesting piece that you wrote that was published in Foreign Policy magazine.
Right.
About this whole thing. And particularly I was struck by your saying, you know, this is a place where you'd spent a lot of time and you've written about it and had been away for a little while. And then when you went back, even you, somebody who had lived in Mexico and reported on Mexico, was surprised by the level of drug-related violence there in the country.
Yeah, it's been very scary. I mean, obviously, I'd been reading the headlines and the news from out of Mexico for, since like 05 and 04, 05 is when it began to heat up. And it was alarming, but it got just progressively more savage and more brazen and more public. One of the things about the drug industry, illegal drug industry in Mexico, which has existed since the United States has had an appetite for the stuff, is that it normally was, for a long time, very isolated, you know, and certain regions, that people didn't broadcast their wars so much. They'd find, you know, a body in the back of a trunk of a car, in a trunk of a car or something, and there was not a lot of publicity surrounding this. You know, it was kind of the thing that the traffickers killed each other off, and that was kind of to be expected, and okay, so what, you know. What's happened lately, among many things now, is that's very alarming, is how brazen it's become. You know, the big banners placed by the cartels in very public places in large cities. You know, at one point throwing a grenade at a television studio, throwing a grenade also at a U.S. consulate in Monterey. A lot of very public killings, beheadings, piles of bodies with messages scrawled on the torso or with pinned to their clothing or what have you. Very public challenges to authority. Of course, there's a famous case recently in Ciudad Juarez where they told the police chief he would have to resign or they'd kill a member of his force, an officer in his force, once every 48 hours. Mm-hmm. They killed one, I think, or maybe two.
I think they killed two, and then he
then
said,
he resigned,
yeah.
This kind of thing didn't happen before, and it's a very it's a real new wrinkle. It makes it very scary. It makes it also what's also happened is that the front in this war in the last 3 years has shifted every few months. So it's a new hot spot every few months, and it's gone. And it generally the hot spots are the areas where either drugs or precursor chemicals come into Mexico, and that's along the coastline, some places, and then also where they go into the United States along the border. And so you get these kind of hot spots shifting: Tijuana, Nogales, Sinaloa, Michoacán, Acapulco, Juarez, Reynosa. You know, it's Laredo, Nuevo Laredo, a while back. It just shifts all constantly, and it's every couple of months there's a new hot spot.
Yeah.
Very alarming.
It's and it seems interesting, you know. In as I said, you make a point in the piece that you wrote for Foreign Policy that maybe it hasn't caught the attention of Americans that it should. And now, interestingly enough, now that we're doing this interview and I'm trying to read up on this, it seems now like everywhere I turn, there's a story on
this.
Well,
now, in the last few weeks, yes.
Yes.
When I was writing that story, as recently as, you know, around Christmas and New Year's and January and so on, that was not the case, you know. And it most definitely was not the case during the presidential campaign, you'll remember. Mexico wasn't even uttered, I think. Even though this kind of violence was fully underway during that time. You know, it was very unsettling for me to watch that campaign take place most of the time because I was thinking, when are they going to start talking about, you know, what's a few hundred miles from our border, you know, or from where I'm sitting right now, you know. So yes, now it's the topic of the day. That this is good, but it's also I'm also wary of this because in the past, Mexico has become of interest to the people in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere, only when it gets really, really bad. Things have got to be really bad. And then as soon as a crisis somewhere else in the world kicks off, then Mexico is immediately put on the back burner and or forgotten entirely. This happened in 9/11. After 9/11, I can tell you that the Bush administration was, you know, really interested in engaging Mexico. It had political change. Vicente Fox had beaten, had removed the party that had controlled the country and had a monopoly on the politics of that country for 71 years, and he'd won. And now was a new time, a time when you could really begin to talk about how we could both work together to solve some of these very naughty problems that we face. Well, 9/11 came along, and boom, Mexico just spent the next 7 years as a non-topic. And so now, I mean, those of us who follow Mexico and have lived there and so on, I'm sure a lot of us, I certainly am greeting with great optimism, I suppose, what's going on now and how Secretary Clinton's going down there. John Kerry's holding Foreign Relations Committee hearings on gun running in El Paso next week. President Obama will be going down there. All of this is wonderful, but it's would be bad if it were the same kind of short-term, short, you know, kind of small-scale vision that, that Washington has viewed Mexico with in the past. We need to view Mexico in terms of long-term engagement, relentless kind of collaboration, getting to know each other. We've been together since the beginning of our two countries, and we don't know anything about one another. That's definitely the case.
Well, as you say, the Secretary of State, Clinton, is going this week or within the next couple of days, and there's a visit planned soon by the president. And apparently the administration is sometime here soon is going to announce what they're going to be doing, particularly to try to deal with the issue of the drug trade and border security and so forth. So at this point, if from anything that you've seen, do you get any hint of what it is the administration is thinking about doing?
I don't. You know, this is the thing. In the campaign, I didn't have any clue about how now President Obama was going to be dealing with Mexico. Zero. You know, all his focus in, when it came to foreign policy was about, you know, other countries and other regions. And so it's going to be very interesting. I would assume, I guess, from what I've heard, and I'm just getting this from, you know, the same newspapers you guys are probably reading, that, you know, a new initiative with regard to gun running, that would be very, very welcome. Mm-hmm. Something that really placed emphasis on all those guns going down to Mexico to fuel this ghastly war. And then some, you know, military help of some kind, training. Some of that's already going on. There's also some interesting things going on at the border between different agencies on the U.S. side and on the Mexican side. Above all, it just I think what's needed, though, is not to let this crisis pass without deepening the relationship and institutionalizing it in a sense. You know, it needs to be a more routine and constant than it's ever been. And I'm afraid that what will happen is once these killings stop, and as I assume they will one day, that attention will turn elsewhere and Mexico will again be forgotten, and the importance of the Mexican relationship with the United States will then be forgotten.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Sam Quiñones, who works for the Los Angeles Times. He's has extensive experience living and reporting on Mexico. He's authored two books about the country. And we're talking about contemporary Mexico, and particularly here we've been talking about the kind of dramatic upsurge in violence, drug-related violence that's happened, what that means for Mexico, what that means for the United States. And questions are welcome. And in fact, we have somebody here ready to go. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller, our first in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'd like you to comment upon what seems to me to be the essence of this problem is the fact that Americans wish to do things that for some reason our government thinks we ought not to do, and that's namely it's using drugs. Every argument I've ever heard for the continuing criminalization of drug usage sounds no different than the arguments that were used to justify the justify prohibition, and with the same results except on a bigger scale this time around.
Yeah.
And the great conservative Nobel laureate economist Milton Friedman even used to say that, you know, that there are two classes of people that drug usage hurts, the people that use them and the people that don't. The people who use them for obvious reasons and the people that don't for the very exact things that you are talking about here, this criminal activity and so forth. Don't you think that really at the end of the day that the only way to solve this is to in some way stop the really ludicrous criminalization of the taking of drugs, change it from a criminal activity to a mental health problem,
right,
and regulate it and control it, but take the profit incentive out to do the things that are happening that you're discussing.
Right.
Thank you very much.
I hope the caller will forgive me that I'm a daily news reporter for a newspaper, and generally speaking, they don't like us talking about our opinions about certain issues, and I would bet one of those, I think, is legalizing whether drugs should be legalized. However, it's clear that, yes, illegal drug demand in the United States is what's fueling that. That is not even a debatable point anymore, of course. and that this industry has grown up for ever since Americans, you know, ever since really the 1960s when Americans developed a healthy appetite for all you know, the drugs that Mexico produced and the drugs that now come through Mexico from Colombia, being cocaine primarily. I would also add this. There's an interesting thing that people who think about this issue don't often take into consideration. And speaking primarily about marijuana. Now, marijuana is often referred to, because it's illegal, you know, as a gateway drug. You smoke marijuana and then you move on to other drugs. One interesting thing about marijuana is that it's also a gateway drug for traffickers, particularly, well, Mexican traffickers. Because it grows very easily in the hills of northwest Mexico, the states of Sinaloa, Chihuahua, and Durango, primarily in those areas, it grows very easily in those areas, and therefore it's kind of the startup drug for traffickers as well. By that I mean that's how they get started in trafficking. They get very easily can obtain a few pounds or kilos, what have you, of marijuana, and traffic that to the United States, smuggle that in, learn how to do the job, learn the trade a little bit, find some clients, and then, of course, the very important thing, develop their startup capital. So illegal marijuana is a startup, is kind of like the first startup loan that you get as a trafficker. You start with that, and in time you develop, again, your clients far into the United States. You develop a confidence in what you do, new techniques perhaps. You learn how to manage the border or navigate the border, and in time you get more and more money, and then and only then do you get the connections and the money that you develop the connections and the money to then branch off and bring in harder drugs like cocaine and develop connections with Colombians who make or sell cocaine. And also nowadays the new arrival is, of course, methamphetamine. You develop connections in buying the precursor chemical, which is ephedrine, to methamphetamine. But most of the time, historically, traffickers in Mexico start with illegal marijuana because it's easy and it's plentiful and grows very easily. And so I don't like to answer the question of how I feel about legalizing drugs. On the other hand, I do think that all the facts need to be considered about this, and one fact that people have not considered is the effect of illegal immigration in starting and providing a leg up, the first few rungs up the ladder for traffickers in Mexico.
Hmm. Well, you know, whenever we do anything that gets anywhere near this subject, we're going to hear from someone making the argument that the caller did, that
yeah.
This is the kind of thing that you can't deal with it. You need to deal with it on the demand side. And actually, I think a lot of people in the United States and law enforcement have said the same thing. You need to deal with it on the demand side,
right,
and not so much on the supply side. But I think it's also strikes me that and from some of the things that I've read about this, that we actually have had some success dealing with the supply side, particularly in places like Colombia and in the Caribbean. And for that reason, that's actually why there has been an uptick in drug activity in Mexico and the associated
violence. What happened was, yes, precisely, your audience may remember that in the 1980s, the cocaine cowboys down in Miami and so on, the Colombians began bringing their cocaine through the South Florida area. And, of course, they began to fight it out for turf and a variety of other things. There were massive shootouts on the streets. The murder rate went sky high. They ran out of room at the morgue there and had to rent trailers, refrigerated trailers, and so on. Well, in the late 80s, really, in the early 90s, the United States government was able to close down that route effectively. And that's when all the Colombian cocaine shifted to Mexico. And the problem was, of course, that Mexico has a 1,952-mile border with the United States, and it's very porous, and it is also a border used to smuggling of all kinds. Back in Prohibition, that's where a lot of the alcohol came from. There's been illegal merchandise smuggled into Mexico when there were very high tariffs in that country for things like perfume and tennis shoes and so on. This was in the 70s and 80s primarily. So it's a place where, you know, routes are kind of already defined and people are already used to it. It's not an alien culture, the smuggling culture there on the border. And that's when you begin to see the cartels really begin to ramp up both in their power, their money, their ability to buy off police and authorities in Mexico. Although that's already happening, I should add, this is not new. That's part of what was not new. That was going on long before, but the increased money just simply adds to that, their ability to do that. And then, of course, also with the money, these guys are greedy, vicious fellas, you know, and they're begin to fight among themselves, and there are a series of wars kick off that are kind of minor league wars compared to what we have now, but are the kind of the roots of what we have now as well, where they begin to there's a lot of rancor and anger over a variety of incidents that take place, and so now these cartels are kind of warring among themselves. That's part of what's going on down here.
Yeah. Let's talk with somebody else. In Marseilles, up in the northern part of the state, line four, toll-free line. Hello.
Thank you. I'm really glad you're talking about this. They've had a special on the History Channel called Gangland, and they mentioned groups, ex-Mexican Army and current Mexican Army, Los Zetas. And now on Lou Dobbs, he's reported that they talk about weapons coming from the United States, and this is all probably true, but a lot of the time, but they're not mentioning that military weapons are getting in the hands of these people, and Los Zetas have infiltrated the army. The Mexican economy is stimulated by American demand for illegal drugs to the tune of $60 billion, according to Lou Dobbs. Now, these weapons are coming from Mexican government arsenals, and Lou Dobbs reports that the Mexican government will not share the serial numbers of these weapons with the American authorities. Typical obstruction, because they don't want to admit that the weapons they're buying from the United States, and they buy weapons from Germany as well, are getting into the hands of the drug dealers. Now, they got a thing they call plata u plomo, silver or lead. When they offer you $500,000 or whatever, they say, you're going to do this for us, or we're going to kill you and your whole family. And so the people down there are being dragged into this involuntarily by this plata u plomo, silver or lead. And why won't the Mexican government, according to Lou Dobbs, share the serial numbers of these weapons, these automatic weapons, heavy weapons? And by the way, Lou Dobbs also reports that Mexican Army has been crossing the border into the United States illegally, and it's rarely reported on the news because they are in cahoots with the smugglers. Not the whole army, but elements of the army, because of the $60 billion that's going down, because the people in this country have always had a tremendous appetite for drugs.
Well, all right. What do you think about that, Mr. Cagnoli?
A few things there, and the caller is largely right. The market for dope in America is considered to be somewhere, and because it's clandestine and illegal, you don't know exactly, but somewhere in the order of $15 to $35 billion. Still quite a bit of money. I'm not sure the $60 billion where that comes from, but that's my understanding from a DOJ report released earlier this year. The caller is correct that the Mexican military is prohibited by Mexican law. This is one of these old laws that really needs to change in this new era, from associating with, quote, foreign agents. And this goes back to Mexico's suspicion of foreigners, and primarily the United States, and the motives that they have due to a lot of things that came due to a lot of things that related to Mexican history. But they cannot, they do not participate with their intelligence as much as they should, and a lot of this has to do with weapons that when the military seizes weapons, oftentimes they don't share that information. Now, when police and federal and state police and local police seize the weapons, oftentimes they do. In fact, I know of many cases in which they do. Now, sometimes the serial number is right. They're transposed incorrectly. They're written down wrong. There's a lot of problems. You can talk to the ATF, and they will tell you a lot of problems exist with regard to transmitting that information so that they can then trace it here in the United States. There is the Los Zetas is an important new phenomenon in all this, and the Los Zetas were formed as they're a bunch of military deserters, special ops military deserters. They became the bodyguards. They were formed as a little contingent crew of the Gulf Cartel, which operates down near the Gulf of Mexico and the Texas border, to be a kind of a bodyguard crew for the leader of the Gulf Cartel, Ocio Cardenas. They then kind of morphed into something much larger. They became much much larger themselves. They trained new people. They, of course, had tremendous military knowledge, both with weapons and with strategy and tactics and so on. And so they become almost a new force themselves. They are not the the Zetas are kind of a semi-cartel almost right now, and they've been one of the wars, for example, several of the wars along the border have happened because they've been trying to move west from down in Texas Rio Grande area, move west along the border and control more territory. The other thing that is true is that these cartel gunmen and these cartels now have tremendous weaponry, and where it all comes from is still a open question. Some of it, I believe, comes from the international black market. Some of it does come from the military, the Mexican military, corrupt members of the Mexican military, and a lot of it too comes from here. You know, you can buy assault rifles, you can buy Barrett 50 caliber sniper rifles here in the United States, and they have, and they've been caught doing this, and so a lot of this does come from there. It's of course fueled again by relentless and huge revenue income from the sale of illegal drugs in the United States.
I want to thank the caller. We're already at our midpoint here, and I want to introduce our guest once again and invite other people to call. Sam Quiñones works for the L.A. Times and has for a number of years now. He's also worked for the English language magazine Mexico Insight and started out as a reporter at the Orange County Register, worked for the Tacoma News Tribune, and has lived in Mexico and written about Mexico sort of on and off since the mid-90s. He's the authors of two books about Mexico, True Tales from Another Mexico, The Lynch Mob, The Popsicle Kings, Chelino and the Bronx. That's University of New Mexico Press, 2001. And also Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration. That was published in 2007, also University of New Mexico Press. He has website, samquiñones.com, if you want to look at that. And also, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, if you have internet access, the Los Angeles Times has a very good website also that they put together where they have collected all of their stories and reporting on Mexico. So if you're interested in this issue and other things that have to do with Mexico, you can take a look at that. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, as the caller points out, and certainly as people will know if they've read some stories about Mexico, being a police officer in Mexico is extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
They're very poorly paid, and both those things together, that's a pretty bad mix. And so as a result of the inability or the unwillingness of local law enforcement to deal with the issue, the government of Mexico has sent the army.
And it's a real important point you bring up, because what this is one weakness, you might say, that this war in Mexico brings out is local government weakness. And you can see that along the border. It's very clear. On the U.S. side, there's a lot of talk nowadays about spillover from Mexico to the United States of this violence, and there are some well-known cases of this. But by and large, that doesn't happen very much. And the reason is because there is a strong network of police agencies, sheriff, cops, state, federal, jails, prisons, courts, on and on and on like that, forming a criminal justice system that most traffickers know is not messing around, no means business. And so that has not happened. If you look at the border towns along the Texas border, for example, crime is very low. While the madness is raging just a few hundred yards away, crime is really low in El Paso, Laredo, McAllen, places like this. The problem is that on one side of this border, there's very strong, able, agile, well-funded local government that can put together that strong, thin blue line that people talk about a lot. On the Mexican side, that doesn't exist. There is not a strong tradition of autonomous and well-funded local government. Local government gets only about 4 or 5% of the total tax revenues of all taxes generated in Mexico. It doesn't have re-elected mayors, and so the mayor comes, brings all his administration with him, and 3 years later he has to leave office and takes everybody with him. So there's this constant improvisation. Lack of funding, improvisation lead to corruption, lead to incompetence, lead to inability to provide even most basic services like paved streets, street lamps, storm drains, and one of the main services that they cannot provide is police services. Strong police, police are very poorly paid. The reason police are very poorly paid, as you mentioned correctly, is that there simply isn't the funding for them at the local level, and nor is there the respect now, frankly, either, or the training, or the equipment, you know. And so all of this means that government looks out across this country for allies in this fight with this kind of hydra-headed beast called the drug cartels, and doesn't find any kind of local allies, the kind of allies that really ought to have been fighting this war and alone on their own and been able to take care of it years ago when these guys were not very strong, you know, when these cartels weren't very strong, when they were small little, you know, hillbilly traffickers, essentially. And that's really one of the main problems that this war points out, that local, strong local government, well-funded, autonomous local government is essential in the fight against criminal organizations. And again, you know, a friend of mine was saying, this guy was talking to me the other day, said, it's like these guys are Tony Soprano, you know? Mm-hmm. But Tony Soprano in the United States never threatened the national government because he had local cops on his case all the time, you know. Tony Soprano in Mexico has grown into a massive national security threat because he's been allowed to fester and become more sophisticated.
Well, one thing that does indeed seem to concern people here in the United States is the possibility that this violence is going to spill over the border. And there has been, well, for example, just yesterday, New York Times front page story,
yeah.
Mexican drug cartel violence spills over alarming U.S.
Yeah,
that's the headline.
Not, let me say
that's
about, something
about
that.
Tucson, and also there have been some concerns, I think, about Phoenix particularly.
Right. Yeah, I wrote a story about Phoenix, where they have certain areas have had problems. In general, it's not happening. It simply isn't happening, though. I mean, there are some areas where these are pockets of very strong, very real problems. For example, Phoenix is the biggest case, not Tucson so much. Phoenix has had 350 or plus kidnappings, ransom kidnappings a year. Now, those statistics are a little confusing because those are really traffickers kidnapping other traffickers. The cops still get involved in a lot of those cases, and they still risk their people, and they still use their resources and budget. But it's not been, there's nobody in Phoenix who's been kidnapped who's a member of not associated with the drug smuggling world. As I mentioned, elsewhere along the border, you look at the statistics. The statistics are very low in the Texas border, for example. Crime is down in San Diego. Crime is really low in El Paso. It's the third safest city in the country, while the rest of the country, Juarez is just a madhouse. I've talked to a number of drug task force chiefs in the last few days trying to get a bead on this story, and everybody says, no, we don't have much of this kind of violence. These guys are very low profile. They keep it quiet. It's in their best interest, of course, to keep it quiet, not have shootouts on the streets the way the Colombians did in Miami in the 80s, you know. Over and over and over, you hear that. I spoke with folks in Atlanta, in Oklahoma, in Colorado, and also along the border of Texas, as I said. And this is a hysteria, I think, that's grown that is really just that. It's not based in fact. It's kind of a hysteria, like, where they kind of come in, this is a terrible thing. There are some examples of it happening, but they're very they're exceptions, you know. And that's not to say, however, that these cartels are not operating in the United States. Of course, they're operating everywhere, and that's where this whole issue begins to connect with illegal immigration. There are Mexican immigrants across the country. You know, from Atlanta to Anchorage, there are Mexican immigrants, and everywhere in between. And so now, yes, the cartels, like any mafia in the past, piggybacks on its immigrant group, and the cartels have piggybacked on these immigrant groups, and now find, you know, they can kind of fit in these areas. I was talking with a guy in a DEA agent in Columbus, Ohio. Columbus, Ohio now has 50,000 Mexican immigrants. And it's now become a hub for cartel drugs, primarily out of the state of Sinaloa in Mexico. So it's you get all these issues kind of converge at some point: guns, immigration, drugs, drug demand. It's all one big hole that I see. But it's very important to point out to people that this kind of violence that they're seeing in Mexico has by and large, really considering how widespread the cartel networks are, has not seeped across the border.
All right. We have some other callers here. Let's talk with somebody again up in the sort of the northwestern part of the state in Paw Paw. This is line one. Hello. Caller there, line one.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, this drug cartel thing, it's almost a no-win situation. My family lives in California, right in the desert there, on Lancaster, Palmdale,
sure.
Napa Valley area. And it's terrible out there. I was back there for Christmas, and my father had passed away, so I was there. In fact, I just got back a couple weeks ago. And it's a nightmare. It's MS-13 has come in and basically ramshot everything out there. I mean, there's gold mines out in those areas. They're turning them into meth labs and drug labs. The National Forest is basically, you cannot go in there anymore because they got big signs out there warning people of pot farms up in the woods. It's gotten out of control. So when you said something about San Diego, I kind of find it hard to believe because that whole area, the 29 Palms and Palm Springs, I've never seen it so bad. I haven't lived out there in 20 years. My family's, I'm a transplant out here, but
mm-hmm.
It's gotten really bad. And I think and you're right, it doesn't get a lot of a play on the news media because they think if you say anything about the Hispanic population, you're being called a racist. And, I mean, people need to start waking up and smelling the roses because they're basically out here now. They're actually in Illinois, MS-13. I mean, people better wake up and basically check it out because it's gotten no play, and at the same time, the situation has gotten worse. But I had to make note of that fact that having been a native Californian for a long time, it's you don't want to live in California, at least the southern half anyway. I'll get off and listen.
Yeah, I mean, he was referring to MS-13, which is the gang called the name of that gang is Mara Salvatrucha. It's a Salvadoran immigrant gang that began in the 1980s with a lot of the arrival of a lot of refugees, essentially from the Salvadoran Civil War, and a lot of guys who had military service, in fact. And they are a kind of a becoming an internet or well, certainly yes, an international gang, certainly a national gang. There's a lot of them in Washington D.C. There's certainly in California and parts of Los Angeles is where they were born. I would simply say that. It most certainly has gotten bad since you've been back, since you've been lived here 20 years ago. But by and large, what we're seeing is, first of all, you're talking about two different issues. One is the gangs that sell the drugs on the street, and those gangs have been a problem for many, many years. In fact, they were far worse of a problem 15 years ago. In fact, the gang problem has significantly improved. I know that may sound strange to you. Significantly improved if you're just judging it from types of crimes committed. An amount of crime committed. LA's gang crime problem is way, way down, less than half of what it used to be. The gangs are one issue. That's one issue that has a very localized root. The cartels are another, and the cartel violence is what I was referring to. The cartel violence that you're seeing in Mexico, where cartels will be fighting over territory and access into the United States, those same cartels will coexist very easily. They're doing so, for example, in Atlanta. They don't feud in Atlanta. They have the same territory. They're in the same area, but they're not finding shootouts. And you'll have an occasional homicide maybe, but it's not a epidemic or rampant kind of thing. And so my own feeling, I know this may sound strange to the caller, but my own feeling is that the gang issue has significantly improved. And I think the police are make note of that all the time. And I think it's clear, too, that you go around neighborhoods that used to have serious, serious gang problems. You don't see the graffiti as much. You don't see the drive-by shootings really as much at all. The gang problem, the localized gang problem, has certainly improved in California, I would say.
All right. Let's go to the community of Belgium, not far from us. Line two. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
I think we got a bad line there.
There we go. Hello.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. I wanted to point out, sir, that the reason why we don't have as much trouble on this side of the border is because it's also a moneymaker here. Now, this may sound very opinionated, but still at the same time, we pump a lot of money into law enforcement, and law enforcement has come to depend upon this money that is essentially drug money. I mean, maybe it doesn't come directly from somebody buying and selling a drug, but it comes from the effect of what drug is doing. So really, it is drug money. lawyers, judges, policemen, everybody is all living off this drug problem, and it's all interrelated.
Well, you know, you're right about that. I think that there's a vast infrastructure we've set up to deal with the drug problem because we've deemed that drugs ought to be, certain drugs ought to be illegal. I can't disagree with that. Of course, you've got, I would say this, in the current context, given the current parameters that we've decided we want to establish, one of the main reasons that there's two main reasons, I would say, in very general terms, why the drug violence has not really seeped over the border to any great extent. One is that we have a very strong criminal justice system that puts people away and doesn't allow them to have visitation with, you know, prostitutes and have big fancy meals the way a guy can look forward to in Mexico, where it's very difficult to break out of and this kind of thing. You know that law enforcement means business in the United States, and I think a lot of people in the cartel world and the drug world don't want to risk that, and they understand that. So they keep a low profile. They want to sell their drugs, they want to make their money, but they don't want to kind of take kind of cowboy-type risks. The other, of course, is, again, very closely related to that, is that these guys want to make their money. They're businessmen. They understand. They're especially kind of, you know, they're like, they're about distribution of product, and the more that they cause problems, the more those distribution lines will be disrupted by local law enforcement and the less money they'll have. And that also means that they will have less revenue to fight their wars nowadays down in Mexico. So it's a twofold issue. I really think that the law enforcement is by and large respected in this country, and particularly because most Mexican traffickers see another kind of law enforcement down in Mexico and know that here that it's not that way. And also they want to make their money. They want to make their profits, and they understand how bad for business it is to start, you know, shooting up a strip mall, say, as the Colombians did fairly often, is my understanding.
I want to thank the caller for his comments. We just have about 10 minutes left.
Yeah.
I want to again introduce our guest, Sam Quinones. He's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, has lived in Mexico and has been writing about Mexico for a long time. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to ask about something that's different, although certainly that's related. How is Mexico doing economically, and how has the country been touched by the economic problems that affect the United States and literally everyone around the world?
Well, you know, Mexico is very connected to the U.S. economy. 85%, I think, of its exports at one point. I'm not sure that's still correct, but at one point, 85% of its exports go to the United States, and so it has been hammered by this downturn, recession. The peso has lost 50% of its value. I think it's now 15 or so to a dollar when it was about 10, I would say maybe 6 or 8 months ago. You also have very high unemployment. And what's happened is this has kind of helped to freeze the illegal immigrant situation as a kind of the way it was back in the late 07, say. People are not coming north because they know that there's not many jobs here. They've heard by now that really it's very expensive to pay for those coyotes to cross you into the United States. And when you get here, you better have a job waiting. If there's not one waiting, it's a big risk to pay that kind of money. On the other hand, Mexican immigrants here have not been going home either. And so it's kind of a static situation that has really been felt on both sides of the border. The other thing that has happened is Mexican immigrants here have many of them have been unemployed or they've been working fewer hours, and so they're able to send far less money home than they once did. So in 07, I believe the remittance transfer was something like $26 billion. Well, that's dropped off by $3 billion in 2008, and I would suspect that figure is going to keep dropping through 2009. And remittances from immigrants are a huge source of foreign exchange for Mexico. It's second only to oil, and so that is another way in which all this has hammered Mexico. Now, of course, the more folks who are desperate, the more folks who are desperate to do illegal things, and will turn to illegal things. And so you already had you know a large reservoir of people who were willing to do this kind of stuff, particularly in certain states of Mexico, I would just have to imagine that that number would now grow as times get tougher.
All right, let's talk with someone in Indiana, Avon, Indiana, on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Tying in, economics with the drug distribution, Mexico has been pushing to send their truck drivers and their heavy equipment and poorly trained people north here. Let's just suppose that we break down and we allow them to come north, invade us from the south into the north. How's that going to affect drug distribution?
Well, there's I suppose with every truck that comes in, there's a chance that it's got cocaine or drugs in it. That's every truck could be, doesn't matter which truck, and those trucks are probably more susceptible than most. I would suspect it. A percentage, and I wouldn't have a clue how high that percentage would be, but a percentage of those trucks would be hiding places for illegal drugs. That's one of the main problems that we have. We have a very rich and vibrant trade with Mexico that produces a lot of jobs in Mexico and produces a lot of jobs here, and but as part of that, you've got illegal drugs in these trucks as well. It's one of the great conundrums. So, I think it would be silly to imagine that these trucks would not come through, some of them anyway, with illegal drugs hidden in them somewhere.
We're just coming down to a couple of minutes left, maybe 3-4 minutes. In Washington, recently now, there's been more and more attention devoted to this as it becomes a more high-profile story, and we have had a lot of people talking in Congress about the possibility that Mexico is on the verge of being a failed state. And, of course, the government of Mexico says, no, that's not true. It's nothing like that and so forth. Just how significant a challenge is this to the government of Mexico?
It's a very significant challenge. It's taxing many of its institutions. And as I said, a lot of the local institutions are simply not up to the job. However, a failed state is this is not Afghanistan. People want other similar cases to make it easy to understand. The problem is it doesn't work that way. It's not Afghanistan. It's not Somalia. It's not Iraq. It is its own case, and it is very serious. That's not just because it's not a failed state doesn't mean that we ought to really be readjusting almost every part of our Mexico policy and deepening our collaboration with that government so that we can both together work on these problems. Because if we let them dangle in the wind, it's just going to get much, much worse, I believe. So, but a failed state, this is a country that does have functioning governments. And it does have places where those governments lose control, the way kind of Chicago lost control when Al Capone was a big problem there in the 20s. Juarez has been similar to that, I would say, recently. Tijuana was a little similar to that recently in the last year or so. You do have these hot spots that flare up and become kind of ungovernable almost, but that is not the case throughout the country. The country, many, many parts of Mexico are not feeling this problem. Many parts of Mexico feel it briefly and then it goes away, this kind of thing. So let's focus this question about whether it's a failed state. I kind of agree with Felipe Calderon on that issue. Mm-hmm. It's not, but that doesn't mean that we should say, oh, it's fine then, no problem. We should have that attitude. We should pay attention to this. We should use this as an opportunity, it seems to me, to deepen the collaboration between these two governments, to strengthen the ties. And together, that is really the only way we can figure out solutions to this. Because it's not these aren't insoluble problems, but they do require kind of bilateral cooperation in a way that the two countries have never achieved in the past.
I think just I want to talk just maybe again a couple minutes left here about a little bit about Mexican politics. I think that a lot of people were expecting that back in 2000 when Vicente Fox was elected president and the power of the PRI, which had been the ruling party for 71 years, was broken. It was the first time that an opposition party candidate won the presidency in I don't know how long. And I think a lot of people thought, well, this really – this is going to be the beginning of a period of major change
for
politics in Mexico. Yeah, I know you did, and a lot of people did, and I think that a lot of people have had now said, you know, it actually, things really didn't change very much at all.
There's good reason. There's reasons that people need to understand for why that didn't, why that hasn't happened so far, and that is, it went from a party, a monopoly party, into a monopoly of a few parties, and those parties, those elites of those parties, now kind of run the country. And divide it up among themselves, even though they may hate each other, they sometimes do. It's they are standing in the way, I think, of real change. And they have, they are the ones in Congress. They are the ones who run Congress. Congress is now the obstacle, in my view, to change in Mexico. It sits on its hands, doesn't do anything. Because there's no re-election of congressmen either. There's no incentive to actually compromise and reach a consensus, battle it out so you come to some compromise on something. Instead, what they do is they sit around and do nothing, and meanwhile the country is kind of hanging there in a sense. And this is why change has not come very quickly to Mexico. Some things have happened, but clearly not the change that people expected. That's going to slow down even more if in July, when they have midterm elections, other parties besides Felipe Calderón's party win more seats. They're able to block more things, and you may see the next 3 years be simply political paralysis, which is what characterized essentially the last 3 years of Vicente Fox's administration. There are a lot of reasons. We probably have to take a whole hour to talk about all the things that involved in Mexican politics and why there hasn't been more change there. But it has kind of reached a paralysis state, and one of the effects, frankly, is this drug war. It simply has not been able to change its institutions enough to make them allies in this war against the cartels.
Yeah, have things settled down? The controversy surrounding the election of Mr. Calderón, have things settled down?
Yes, there's still he for your audience. I mean, he won a very very slim victory in 2006. And the opposition party that came closest felt that it was a lot of fraud and this kind of thing. He's now recognized as the president of Mexico, and that's not a question, except for a group of people on the left. However, that hasn't made his job any easier in Congress. Congress is still an institution that is really run by the party leaders who are in there, and they see no reason, have no reason really, to compromise or to reach consensus. Now, this cartel war, I was hoping would be kind of the foot that kicked the door in a little bit. I don't know. It's happened a little bit, but not again. The rest of the world is rushing ahead. China and India have made huge reforms, and so on. Mexico remains kind of mired in its authoritarian one party. Past a little bit.
Well, there we're going to have to stop. If you're interested in reading more about the story that we're talking about, one thing that you could do is go to the website of the Los Angeles Times. They've done a lot of reporting on the issue, and they have a really nice website that you can look at. Also, you can look for the work of our guest, Sam Quiñones, who works for the LA Times. He's authored two books about Mexico, and you want to find out more about him, you can go to his website, which is samquiñones.com. And Sam, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, certainly my pleasure. Thanks very much.
Programming here on AM 580, made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at tnol.com. We'll break right now, as usually do, for an update on the markets and news, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Wheat is showing some weakness on the day, while corn is a mixed affair, and beans are showing strength, bull spreading the feature there. Let's look at the particulars. May wheat in Kansas City, it is now trading at 5.94 3/4, down 9 1/4. July, 6.05, down 9 3/4. September, 6.15 1/2, down 9 1/2. May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 5.43 1/4, down 6. July, 5.55 3/4, down 6. September, 5.80, down 6 1/4. May corn, 3.95 1/2, unchanged. July, 4.06, unchanged. September, 4.15, down 1/2. December, 4.27, down 1/4. March of 2010, 4.38 1/2, unchanged. May crude, 52.92, down 87 cents now. The April ethanol contract at 161 is up 0.2, and the April RBOB at 149 9/10 is up 1 1/10. May beans, 9.65 3/4, up 10 1/4. July, 9.61 3/4, up 9.